You're listening to The Sound Off. The Sound Off. With the Solomonster. Solomonster.
How did you feel, Jerry, when you realized that you let your mother down?
I'm not your average jabroni. I'm like a big purple pinwheel, Rock, so go ahead and blow me.
Sound Off 148 on SCScoops.com for Sunday, February 27th, 2011. I'm the Solomonster. Boy, do we have a lot to get to. There is no time to waste, and with a two-hour show last week, I would really like to just blow through this stuff. Tons of WWE, TNA, and other miscellaneous news bits in what has been a very busy week in the world of pro wrestling. On the road to WrestleMania, a lot of TNA happenings as well. Some good, some bad. Actually, mostly bad, let's be honest. But we'll get to all that. First thing I want to do here is talk about Raw from this past week and some other WWE notes, and then we'll kind of move on to some of the other stuff. And Raw this past Monday night was a very big show. Of course, it was the post-pay-per-view edition of Monday Night Raw. Now, for those of you who might have missed it, but got knocked down the front page a little too quickly, and you are not a subscriber through iTunes, you may not have heard episode 147, which went up on President's Day, gave my thoughts on the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view, which I thought was actually a pretty damn good show, which featured to this point the match of the year in WWE, the SmackDown Elimination Chamber match, which just kicked all kinds of ass last Sunday. Especially a lot of the stuff from Edge and Rey Mysterio, who started the Chamber match and ended the Chamber match. Of course, Edge came out victorious. He who will defend the World Heavyweight title against Alberto Del Rio at WrestleMania. John Cena wins his version of the Elimination Chamber for the Raw brand. He will challenge The Miz. No great surprise there. Miz, of course, beat Jerry Lawler in what was a pretty good little match for the championship at the pay-per-view. And all of that led into Raw this past Monday. Now, the first thing I want to mention here is we have seen, and it's been this way for a couple of years now, but it just seems like it is happening nonstop. I mean, the last couple of shows, it's been quite nauseating. The number of times we have to see a wrestler point up at the WrestleMania marquee. Now, it's not their fault. They're obviously being told to do this, but that's not the point. The point is, and I made this comment, I think, on Facebook after Raw Monday night, that if I were in charge of WWE on my first night in, I would take a Panzerfaust, which is a bazooka, for those of you who have not played some of the old World War II games, that's what a Panzerfaust is. I would take a bazooka and blow that fucking WrestleMania sign to smithereens. That's the first thing I would do. First quarter segment on the show, I would blow it to bits. Because it is so forced and just hokey looking. When you have two wrestlers in particular, let's say, who are doing a stare down, as we saw on Monday night, and they slowly gaze upon the WrestleMania sign. Really? Is that necessary for every single WrestleMania match, every single WrestleMania participant to look up at the sign? What do they do before the sign starts? I should go back and try to figure out exactly when that sign first made its appearance, which WrestleMania it was for. I want to say that it was WrestleMania 20 back in 04 is when this stupid shit started, but I'd have to go back and do some research, and quite frankly, I just can't be bothered to do that right now. So I noticed that a couple of times on Raw Monday night, including one of the big segments on the show, which of course included the return of The Undertaker, which if you have listened to this show before, you go to SC Scoops and really any wrestling site the last couple of weeks, including the website for the Save Mart Center in Fresno, which is where the event took place. They kind of spoiled it a couple of weeks ago by promoting that this particular show would feature the return of the Dead Man, who we have not seen since the Buried Alive pay-per-view last year, when he was in fact buried alive by Kane and the members of Nexus in a storyline that will likely be forgotten. Now, of course, when they started airing these 2:21:11 vignettes about 3 or 4 weeks ago, people on the internet took it upon themselves to decide that this video, in fact, was not for The Undertaker. This was a video that was prophesizing the forthcoming arrival of Sting in WWE. Sting, of course, being the former WCW franchise player that never once signed with Vince McMahon. He never, ever competed in a single WWE match. And so the real allure to Sting wasn't so much Sting himself, who's 51 going on 52 years old. And if you want to see Sting, he's been on TNA television for the last 6 years or so. But just the idea of Sting being in WWE got people whipped up into a frenzy. And they put this fantasy match together in their heads with some great fake posters for the pay-per-view, Sting versus Undertaker, really good stuff. But the fact is, it was never going to be Sting. And it was, in fact, a video for The Undertaker. They started the show with the countdown. The countdown expired in about midway through the show, and there he was, The Undertaker. Now, when The Undertaker came down to the ring, and he got a pretty good pop from the crowd, almost immediately, when his music ceased, we heard the music of Triple H. Triple H, who we have been waiting for his return now for probably a few months, and it just kept getting pushed back and pushed back, because there were plans originally for him to come back at the end of 2010 and perhaps then appear in the Royal Rumble, and just kept getting pushed back. And there he was, looking as big as ever, although not, you know what, not quite as big and jacked as he was in 02, although that was a different time and a different era. But nonetheless, looking in pretty good shape. Triple H comes out. He looks pissed off about something. And the thing about this segment was it went on for several minutes, and not a single word, not a single syllable was uttered by either man the entire segment. Which at first, when that segment faded to commercial, I thought, well, that was a little disappointing. But the more I think about it, and I've gone back and I've watched the segment a few times, I actually like it a lot. Just because they have 6 weeks to build up WrestleMania. And a lot of this stuff could peak or kind of hit its climax a little too early. You don't want to blow your load in 1 week. So there was no talk of stipulations. There was no long, drawn-out explanation from Triple H on why he wants to face The Undertaker. Because I'm sure it's going to come. It'll probably come as early as this Monday. But in week one, there was no need for it. And people in the arena, people on TV, they knew exactly what was going on. They knew that we had just seen the setup for one of the main event matches at WrestleMania this year. And both guys, for what it's worth, did a fine job with their mannerisms, their facial expressions. Undertaker almost came off as a bit of a heel in this segment, and Triple H got far more cheers than he did. But that sets up the Undertaker-Triple H WrestleMania match that I talked about on Sound Off recently. And, you know, a match that will probably, before it's all said and done, see some sort of involvement by Shawn Michaels, who is likely going to be the tie that binds here to the storyline. You know, Triple H's buddy was beaten 2 years in a row by The Undertaker at WrestleMania. The first time he got beat, it drove Shawn Michaels bonkers to the point that, you know, he was on TV every week demanding a rematch with The Undertaker, who kept turning him down. It drove Michaels crazy. Triple H couldn't talk any sense into his friend. And Michaels went to WrestleMania last year and lost again, only this time he lost his career. And you can argue that, well, it doesn't really make any sense, because there was a full month after WrestleMania last year that Triple H was on TV before Sheamus beat him up and he disappeared, and he didn't seem overly concerned about seeking revenge on The Undertaker then. All of a sudden, you know, a year later, he's pissed off. Well, you know, it's a logic hole, but I've seen far more gaping holes of logic in the product. I can't really find too much fault in that. You know, you've got a good backstory here. And you know Shawn is going to be there because he's going into the Hall of Fame. He will be in Atlanta. The point is, it wouldn't shock me if he did, in fact, end up being some sort of special guest referee or ringside for the match. I'm sure he will be. And we'll hear about that and find out more about stipulations in the weeks to come. Now, there's been talk about this being streak versus career, just like last year, which I think might be a little bit of overkill, doing the same stipulation 2 years in a row. The more I think about this, and a lot of you guys have written into me as well, saying that if Triple H was to put his career on the line and be serious about staying out, because there's no way he's beating The Undertaker at WrestleMania. So if Triple H is serious about putting his career on the line, even if he does wrestle again, it doesn't really have the same kind of oomph that it might otherwise, because here's a guy who's been off television for almost a year. He's already been gone. All of a sudden, he's back, and he's potentially going to lose a match at his first pay-per-view back that will then require him to disappear again. So who cares? I don't know that they need this, the career stipulation. Maybe they won't go in that direction because, you know, when Shawn Michaels said that he was done wrestling, that this was really going to be it for him if he lost, I believed him, and I still believe him when he says that he will not wrestle another match ever again. But the thought of Triple H, who is essentially going to be running this company for many, many more years yet to come, and yes, he's 40 years old, 41 years old, but he's not an old, old guy. He's had a lot of injuries, a lot of muscle tears. His body is probably more broken down in that respect than Shawn Michaels' body is. But Triple H is not going anywhere. And I just find it incredibly difficult to believe that at no point will he have the desire to climb back into the ring for another match. So already you have a stipulation where if he does put his career on the line, it's hard for me to believe in a stipulation like that with him. Whereas with Shawn Michaels, I fully believed it. So we'll see where they go with this. I thought the initial segment was great. And from what I understand, what's even better about this, apparently the two of these guys are pretty much booking their own feud. They have decided to or have been given the power to plan their entire storyline out on their own, pretty much without any involvement whatsoever from the writing team. And I think we've seen examples in the past where we've read, for example, Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho back in 2008, who had a great, in fact, one of the great WWE feuds of the last decade. And, you know, the thing at SummerSlam where Jericho punched Shawn's wife in the mouth, you know, presumably on accident. A lot of the promos and stuff. And that, really, if you think back to that Shawn Jericho feud from 08, it goes back. It was just fantastic how that whole thing unfolded earlier in the year with Chris Jericho essentially doing nothing wrong. You know, Jericho was a babyface. He was accusing Shawn Michaels of being a liar. This was when Shawn was in his feud with Batista. Shawn feigned a knee injury that, you know, Chris Jericho didn't buy into, but the fans, you know, did. And as it turned out, Shawn was lying, and that's where this whole, you know, Jericho calling everybody a hypocrite thing came from. It led very nicely into their feud. All of that stuff was booked by those two guys almost completely independent of the writing team. And that's probably a big part of why it was so good. Undertaker and Triple H, say what you want to about these two guys, they have a mind for the business. They've been around the business for a long, long time. They've been in this company each for a number of years. And I have faith that they will book a feud heading into their own match at WrestleMania that will be pretty damn good, with very little in the way of goofy comedy and goofy bullshit put in there by the creative forces in WWE. So when I read that, I thought, well, you know what? This is going to turn out to be a pretty good storyline. Let's see where it goes. Now, we also got the next step in the, I guess, evolution of the Michael Cole, Jerry the King Lawler storyline. Michael Cole gets in the ring and he conducts an interview with Jerry Lawler, who did not do commentary up until that point on the show on Monday. And Lawler was not being receptive to any of Cole's questions until Cole brought up Lawler's dead mother. And I noticed on my Facebook page people were up in arms. Some people were up in arms about this. Oh, how dare they? How classless. I didn't have a problem with this at all. In large part because I'm almost positive that Lawler probably, it was his idea. I don't know that for a fact. I mean, at the very least, he okayed it. But it wouldn't shock me if this was actually his idea. You know, based on his own booking from years in Memphis, you know, Lawler is not averse to doing a storyline like this. And quite frankly, there was nothing tasteless about it. What was so tasteless about it? Did Michael Cole call Jerry Lawler's dead mother a whore? Did he say that she was in hell? No, this was not a repeat of what we saw with Eddie Guerrero a couple of years ago when they had Randy Orton go on SmackDown and tell Rey Mysterio that Eddie's in hell. You know, within 3 months of him dying. This was a completely different situation. That's what you call a tasteless angle. I didn't look at what happened on Monday night as being tasteless. And even Michael Cole, and you can argue his character was being disingenuous, but even he went out of his way twice to say, no disrespect, no disrespect. Your mother is up in the heavens, and you let your mother down. I thought it was great, 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 great heat. And I didn't see anything wrong with this at all. Whereas if you have, for example, on Raw, the announcers a couple of weeks ago bashing the Divas and calling Natalya fat and all of this stuff, there's a difference there. Because in that case, that's just them being juvenile and mean-spirited with no real storyline purpose. You know, if that whole thing was going somewhere, I would say, okay, you know what? At least they're going somewhere with this. But they went nowhere with it, just as I predicted, just as I knew, just as I thought. They just went on commentary. Apparently something happened behind the scenes with Natalya and perhaps the Hart Dynasty members who have just been buried so far beneath the earth these last few months that I don't even think that anybody knows of their existence anymore. But that shit went nowhere. And that was just being mean and juvenile for the sake of being mean and juvenile. This, at least, is going somewhere. And I had no problem with it. So, you know, people need to, you know, not get their undies in a bunch over this. And I thought Lawler was great. He showed, you know, a great passion in this segment. I mean, newsflash, I know. Well, what a shock. Jerry Lawler is great. He basically just said, listen, you know, even if it gets me fired, I don't care. I'm getting my WrestleMania match, and I'm issuing a challenge to you right now for a match. And, of course, Cole turned him down, and that's fine. That's exactly how I would have done it, because, again, you have 6 weeks to build up this pay-per-view, and you've got to take your time. Plus, if I'm Michael Cole, why the fuck would I agree to something like that? He has no incentive to agree to get into the ring at WrestleMania and have his ass handed to him by an experienced veteran. You know, if I'm Michael Cole, I like my cushy little job at ringside. I want to call WrestleMania. I don't want to get my ass kicked. Now, my guess is in the next couple of weeks that Lawler will somehow coax him, obviously, into a match. Perhaps they're not going to do a straight match with the two of them. Maybe they are going to do something where Alex Riley is kind of a representative for Cole in the match. But whatever they're going to do, they're going to take their time to get there, and I have no problem with it. You know, Lawler climbed out of the ring to go after Cole to try to get an answer out of him. Cole splashed some water in his face. The crowd went, ooh, it was great. Cole ran off. As a heel, as a chicken shit heel, Michael Cole is fantastic. As an announcer, he still sucks. So Lawler got on commentary at that point to take over with Josh Matthews, who's getting better by the week. And all of this makes me wonder, and I'm looking forward to this, by the way. If there's a Lawler-Cole match at WrestleMania, I don't know if Jim Ross will end up having some sort of involvement as far as maybe, you know, even if it's just, you know, if the match happens midway through the show, I don't see how you can have Cole and or Lawler just simply go back to the announce table after their match. So maybe Jim Ross comes out to kind of, you know, substitute for Cole for the rest of the show. I have no idea whether or not that's something that's even being considered, but it's certainly something I would think about doing. And it also makes you wonder, and it's got to make them wonder, exactly when do you put this match on? In what position do you put that match on the WrestleMania card? You don't want to put it too early in the show. If, let's say, Cole, for example, is going to get his ass kicked and not return to the announce booth, you probably want to do it later in the show, maybe even before the main event. You know, back in the day, they used to have a big match towards the end of the show, and then usually there would be some sort of Divas match as like a buffer, and then you would bring the crowd back up for the main event. You know, maybe Lawler vs. Cole will fill that role this year at WrestleMania. I don't know, but I like what they're doing. And, you know, if the end result of all this is Michael Cole getting his comeuppance after just being completely obnoxious for months and months and months, that's the payoff you would hope for, because if Cole doesn't get what he's got coming to him, then to me, you know, the last 6 or 8 months of this bullshit commentary of his that we've been putting up with would be a complete waste of time. We had John Cena at the beginning of Raw responding to The Rock. I had a feeling we might see a little bit of the old school Cena come out, and that's exactly what we did have on Monday night. We saw the old school rapping version of John Cena on Monday night. And let that be a lesson to everybody out there who thinks that, you know, all I think is that John Cena is horrible at promo. I never said that John Cena was horrible at promos without putting in the little caveat that scripted promos, material that Cena is given, makes his promos god-awful. But Cena on his own is actually pretty good. And what we saw on Monday night was Cena being given the freedom to come up with his own rap, his own retort to The Rock, which I thought, even though I still think The Rock was better, his promo was better overall, I thought Cena's rap was actually pretty damn good. And it was, in many respects, it was very non-PG. It's obvious that they're pushing the boundaries of PG here on the road to WrestleMania, which I think is fantastic. And by the way, anybody who's been bitching at all in the last couple of years about WWE going PG and getting away from what brought them to the dance, this is not an official departure from PG, but this is exactly what all of you people have been waiting for, and yet you still continue to bitch. You're getting an edgier product. You're getting promos that are slowly but surely sounding more and more like Attitude Era promos. Not exactly, but, you know, you should be enjoying this. For all the people who have been bitching and moaning about this shit the last couple of years, enjoy it, because I don't know that this is going to last much longer. Instead of continuing to criticize, why don't you just sit back and enjoy, because this is what you've been asking for. You know, Cena coming out there with a pinwheel in his hand, telling Rock to blow him, and telling Rock, you know, handling his balls, his bowling balls and all that stuff. I mean, you know, that's classic old school Cena right there from 2002, 2003. And I enjoyed it, and I'll enjoy it until they stop doing it, which I'm sure they will at some point. So anyway, this is the best build up to a match that we're never going to see that I've ever seen. And for those of you who still remain unconvinced that we are not going to get Rock versus Cena in a match at WrestleMania, well, I really don't know what to tell you. I would think that Cena winning the Elimination Chamber at last weekend would have sealed the deal, but some people still think that Rock is going to get a match with John Cena at WrestleMania. Now, if Rock were to change his mind, you know, with all the reactions that he's been getting, and he's got, you know, he's got wrestling in his blood, he loves this. If Rock was to have a change of heart and say, you know what, I would like to wrestle John Cena, I think that would be a big-time money match. It's too late to do it at WrestleMania, in my opinion. You know, if I'm WWE, I stay the course. You've got a plan in place, you move forward with that plan. But you know what? It's not out of the realm of possibility that they could do Cena vs. Rock at a different pay-per-view. Conceivably, they could do it this year at SummerSlam. To me, WrestleMania next year in Miami would seem like the best place, but that's a year. That's a long time to wait. That's a long time to wait. I don't know that I would wait that long. The key to all of this is WrestleMania. What do you do with Rock and Cena? If there's any possibility at all that Rock might wrestle another match, and I still am convinced he won't. This is all hypothetical. But if there's any remote possibility that it could happen at some point, the reason people are so into this right now is not that you have these two baby faces who are friendly with each other, cutting promos on one another. It's because people are looking at this in some ways, not exactly, but in some ways as a Bret Hart Shawn Michaels dynamic, where people knew that these two guys hated each other. And all the back and forth in 97 between Bret and Shawn felt real, and it probably was because most of it was real, in terms of the hatred that these two men shared for one another. And when you have a real rivalry or a perceived real rivalry like that, it really gets people revved up. They really get into it more. It's kind of the UFC mentality. You have a lot of converted wrestling fans who have become MMA fans, and I think that's because they want real controversy. They want real, genuine bad blood between two people that results in a match or a fight. And people right now, I think, perceive that The Rock and John Cena still have some legitimate heat with one another. And they're kind of, you know, WWE is playing off of that perception right now. Even though Rock and Cena are totally cool with each other in real life, that's not what a lot of people think. So if I'm WWE, I want to milk this for all it's worth. And if there's any possibility at all that you could do a Rock-Cena match at some point, I would want to keep it going. You know? I mean, even if you have the two guys shake hands at WrestleMania, that doesn't mean that they have to like each other. It could be a begrudging, they could shake hands begrudgingly. Leave the door open for some more, animosity down the road. So, I don't know what their plans are for the end of the pay-per-view. I mean, my guess up to this point has not really changed. I figure they're going to do something, not necessarily Austin Tyson in 98, like I talked about last week. It actually wouldn't really make any sense unless Rock is going to referee the match. And it's not like Miz is so intimidating that in order to defeat the Miz, you know, John Cena had to get together and huddle with The Rock, you know, 2 months before WrestleMania to devise some sort of evil plan to confuse The Miz and cause him to lose at WrestleMania. Cena can beat him very handily if he wanted to. But my guess is we're going to see The Rock kind of endorse John Cena, even if it's just through a handshake or, you know, raising his hand, presenting him with the championship belt at the end of the pay-per-view, in the hopes that perhaps Cena, who, even though he's been the top guy in this company now for a number of years, there's still something missing from Cena. The fans, I think, especially those old-school fans, are missing. There's some lack of respect here somewhere for Cena, and you know, perhaps they feel that if Rock was to give him some rub and kind of endorse him and basically say, you know what, this guy's not all that bad, that perhaps he would turn a corner with the fans, even though I don't think that's ever going to happen until he retires, which will not be for some time. So I really liked Cena's rap. I'm anxious to see how The Rock responds. If I had Rock on Raw at all, again, before WrestleMania, it would be one more time at the most, maybe in 2 weeks. And perhaps he would do a face-to-face with Cena. You know, they're not gonna touch one another. And perhaps The Miz comes out, you know, and interrupts the Rock Cena segment. So you leave some of that for the pay-per-view. But I'm digging what they're doing. I really am. I mean, in my opinion, WWE, it's far from perfect. Don't get me wrong, but they've got a lot of different things going on right now, and the product just feels fresher for some reason. You know, The Rock probably has a lot to do with that, him being back for the first time in 7 years, the stuff with him and Cena, Lawler and Cole, you know, with Lawler getting his first WrestleMania match and Cole hopefully getting what he has coming to him. At the same time, they're still pushing some younger guys. You know, The Miz is going to the main event of WrestleMania. Alberto Del Rio is getting a championship opportunity against Edge. That'll be a fresh match. Undertaker, who's been gone for a couple of months, is back. Triple H, who's been gone for almost a year, is back. You know, Shawn Michaels will be at WrestleMania. Whatever capacity it is, he's going into the Hall of Fame. I expect that Steve Austin will be at WrestleMania, probably to pimp out the new season of Tough Enough. And in fact, I would be stunned, if we didn't get some sort of Rock Steve Austin segment at Mania, either in the ring or if they bump into each other backstage and start cracking jokes. You've got Austin and Rock in the same building on the same show. You got to get them in a segment together. So there's a lot of different things going on in WWE right now. Some bad, you know, but a lot of good stuff. Even Punk and Randy Orton. Punk is awesome, and it's a fresh feud for Randy Orton that doesn't see him competing for the championship, which is A-OK in my book. As a WWE fan, as a you know, somebody who always gets more excited around WrestleMania season, this WrestleMania didn't look like it had a lot of hope a couple of weeks ago, and now I feel a lot differently about it now, and I just hope over the course of the next 6 weeks that, again, they don't run out of steam, and hopefully they will. They've got some fresh, exciting stuff up their sleeves, because right now I think is a pretty good time to be a wrestling fan. Now, with that being said, not a big fan of the way Raw ended on Monday night. How many times can we see the same angle where you have feuding tag team partners? I mean, how many times have we seen this just leading up to WrestleMania alone? I mean, I know of at least 7 or 8 different instances where this has been done in the past. And more often than not, it seems, they actually end up winning the tag team championships, which renders the belt even more meaningless. And what we saw on Monday night, I mean, for anybody who thought those belts still had some value left in them, boy, did they really suck the life out of those two giant pennies, which are the new tag team titles, on Monday night. Now, first of all, they had Miz basically out there beating the Nexus for the belts all by himself, which is good in that it made Miz look a bit like a badass. But, of course, the titles changed yet again just a couple of minutes later. Nexus cashed in on their tag team title shot. I'm sorry, not Nexus, the Core. Getting my factions mixed up here. So the Core cashes in on their rematch, and the crowd, what I did notice during the second match, when essentially it got restarted, is that the crowd was really getting into The Miz as a babyface. I mean, the crowd was going apeshit for this guy, and he was getting beaten down and reaching for the hot tag, and the crowd was going absolutely nuts, and that was actually pretty cool to see. And gives me hope that at some point down the road, as good as he is as a heel, and as hateable as he is, The Miz may be a big-time babyface when the time comes. Now is not that time, but that was interesting for me to see. Of course, at the end, Miz screws John Cena. Why he did this, I don't know. You know, why he was okay with winning the tag team titles earlier, and, you know, now he all of a sudden doesn't really give two shits about them. It just makes the belts look so... I don't even know what a right word would be here. Just completely and utterly useless and meaningless. And Cena, of course, is shocked by this development at the end of the show, meaning he's even dumber than he looks. Just not a fan. I mean, of all the good stuff on Raw Monday night, and I thought overall it was a pretty good show, of all the good stuff, that's how you end the show, with one of the worst segments on the entire program. So to me, that was a letdown. But I still thought Raw overall was a pretty strong show. And like I said, we got about 6 weeks or so, 5 or 6 weeks left until WrestleMania. A lot of good stuff, a lot of bad stuff, I'm sure we'll see. But hopefully the build to the big matches will continue to be as strong as it was this week. Because overall, I give it a thumbs up. They also announced on Monday night Hacksaw Jim Duggan as the second inductee into the Class of 2011 Hall of Fame. He will be joining Shawn Michaels in Atlanta on April 2nd for the Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Hacksaw being put into the hall by the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, who had a actually initially in their Mid-South days with Bill Watts in the mid-80s. DiBiase and Duggan were actually partners. They were part of a faction. If I remember correctly, because I was doing some reading up on this, it's part of a group called the Rat Pack. And then eventually I think they began feuding, and Duggan had some of the best matches of his career in Mid-South in the 80s with Ted DiBiase. So for those of you wondering what the connection is between the two men, that would be it. The only drawback is WWE does not own any of that Mid-South wrestling footage, or at least the library. They is one of the few that they still have not been able to purchase and do not have access to. And that's why the only clips of Duggan that we got in that video they showed on Monday was from his WWE run. There was no Mid-South footage in there at all, which is very disappointing. And I never got to see much of that Mid-South footage myself. I think I've seen some on YouTube. But as a you know, as a fan, I wouldn't mind seeing footage of supposedly the days that Jim Duggan was a great wrestler. Because anybody who knows Duggan strictly from WWE knows him as being a very one-dimensional guy who looked a little bit, well, that would be a little politically incorrect if I used that word, but let's just say he was special. And Duggan did not look like a very intelligent individual, if you listen to any of his promos, but the fans, more often than not, were into him. And, I mean, at one point, he was booked as one of the top baby faces in the company. You know, he was having matches and lumberjack matches with Andre the Giant on the main event of some house shows. I mean, they've shown house shows on Classics on Demand in the past where, you know, Duggan and Andre were having these lumberjack matches in the main event of shows at the Boston Garden. And they were terrible matches. And that wasn't just because of Jim Duggan. At that point, Andre was pretty much done. But the point is, in WWE, had a great career. He didn't win any championships, although that should not deter people from being put into the Hall of Fame because, again, in pro wrestling, you are given championships. And so, you know, you may have some great wrestlers who politically or for whatever reason never won a title. That doesn't mean they don't deserve to go into the Hall of Fame. I mean, Jake Roberts never won a championship in WWE. And I think there's probably very few people listening to this show right now who would argue that Jake Roberts does not deserve a spot in the Hall of Fame, in spite of whatever personal demons and transgressions he may have. Let's be honest. I mean, you probably have a ton of people already in the Hall of Fame who, if you were judging them purely based on the kind of person they are in real life, would have no business being within 50 feet of a Hall of Fame. So, to me, that doesn't mean anything. So, you know, Duggan's going to go in. He'll be inducted by the Million Dollar Man. Apparently, any plans to make this a WCW-themed class, well, that's not going to happen now. And from what I understand, and again, if you don't want to be spoiled by who will be going into the Hall of Fame over the next couple of weeks, as far as the other announcements, if you don't want to know, if you want to be surprised, first of all, good luck with that. Because if you're going to be on the internet and you're going to be on SE Scoops, you're going to end up finding out anyway. But you might want to skip ahead here. Apparently, the confirmed or all but confirmed names for the remainder of the class of 2011 include Abdullah the Butcher, who I think I might have mentioned as a pretty distinct possibility on the show a couple of weeks ago. Triple H actually was on a radio show and claimed that he had pushed for Abdullah to be put in the Hall of Fame. Of course, Abdullah owns and runs a, I think it's a ribs and Chinese restaurant in the Atlanta area. The Road Warriors apparently are going to be going into the Hall of Fame, which I might have actually answered a question on this very podcast a week ago or 2 weeks ago about the Road Warriors and how they were supposed to go into the Hall of Fame in 06 when they were in Chicago. An Animal insisted that he had one more run left in him, and so they didn't want to put them in the Hall of Fame just yet. Apparently, they're going to be going in this year. Bullet Bob Armstrong, the father of WWE referee Scott Armstrong, and Brian Armstrong, the former Road Dog, who, from what I understand, will probably be at the Hall of Fame ceremony and might even be inducting his father into the Hall of Fame. So that would be Road Dog's big comeback with WWE. So yeah, Bullet Bob is going in, and apparently rounding out the class will be Tammy Sitch, the former Sunny in WWE. I guess under the moniker that she was the true first diva in WWE. You know, Miss Elizabeth was the first lady of pro wrestling, but the first diva, I guess, was Sunny. You know, Sunny had a pretty good run in WWE. It wasn't a terribly long one. You know, when she came in as a manager of the Body Donnas, or rather, she was part of the Body Donnas. She was the manager of Chris Candido initially. That was in, I want to say, mid-95. And I'm pretty sure she was in the company up until mid-98 is when she either quit or was fired. And, you know, she did announcing for them towards the end of her run. She wasn't just a manager. She did manage the Body Donnas. She managed the Smoking Guns. She might have even managed the Godwins for a brief period of time. She was the manager for Farouk when he came into WWE initially with that awful blue Roman gear. And she was the manager for LOD 2000 when Hawk and Animal came back to WWE in 1998 at WrestleMania that year. So, you know, her time in WWE was pretty good. She managed a lot of different people. She was on television quite often. She did these very racy photo shoots at a time when the product was really only just beginning to take an edgier turn. And she was a sex symbol in WWE back then, no mistake about it. She was a beautiful woman. And, you know, even now, she's been through a lot. You know, she's had some well-documented drug and alcohol issues. And she does not look like the Sunny of 12 or 13 years ago. But let's be honest. I mean, any woman, any female that was, you know, in wrestling 13 years ago is not going to look, you know, in 2011 the way they looked back then. And all in all, I still think she's a pretty girl. So whatever. Apparently she's going into the Hall of Fame. I just find it ironic that Sunny and Shawn Michaels are apparently going into the Hall of Fame at the same time. I just... Anybody that knows the stuff between the two of them in the past, I just find that a little bit ironic. SmackDown thoughts here. I just want to run through this real quick. I have not seen all of SmackDown yet, but I have seen the important parts, at least I think the important parts. And what I enjoyed was seeing Dusty Rhodes going heel, apparently, helping his son Cody Rhodes beat the crap out of Rey Mysterio and leave him laying. Apparently, Dusty is going to be in Cody's corner, I would presume, for Cody's match with Rey at WrestleMania. Again, I talked about this last week for the people who are upset that, you know, WWE is mistreating Rey Mysterio, in a way, by putting him in what is perceived to be a really low undercard match with a jobber like Cody Rhodes. This was Rey's idea. He likes Cody Rhodes a lot. He sees something in him, and he wanted to give Cody a high-profile match at WrestleMania, so I respect the hell out of Rey for doing it, and I don't know, you know, I think the two of them are going to have a damn good match. I just have a feeling about that. You know, Cody will probably show us some stuff that we haven't seen out of him, and even though he's not, he's physically hurting right now, I think Rey will have a great performance as well. And it'll be great to see Dusty at Mania, so I'm looking forward to that. That'll be cool. We also saw the Big Show apparently beat Wade Barrett by countout. And then the core came out, and Big Show chased him, and I think he beat up Justin Gabriel with a chair. You know, one of the things I wonder about this is if we might see some sort of core against Big Show and Diesel tag team match at WrestleMania. Of course, At the Royal Rumble, when Diesel got thrown out and he was walking to the back, he passed by the Big Show, and the two of them exchanged looks. They kind of had a stare down of sorts for a few seconds and then kept on walking, and people thought that maybe we were going to have a Big Show versus Diesel match at WrestleMania, which we're not. But perhaps they could do a tag match and get Nash involved in there, where the two of them take on the core. You know, Nash made an interesting comment on Twitter over the past week where he, I think he was answering a question from somebody who asked, you know, when are we going to see you again? Or when are we going to see Diesel back on TV again? And Nash told the person that he signed a 5-year contract with WWE. I presume that's the Legends deal that he signed. And he said, I'm sure that in the next 5 years, you all will hear that Diesel engine again. Trust me. You know, and I just wonder if maybe sooner rather than later. You know, Nash has been known to sweet-talk his way into certain situations, and maybe he can sweet-talk his way into a WrestleMania payday this year. So, we'll see. Alrighty. Now, before we get into the TNA stuff, a couple more WWE items here. First of all, I just want to mention this. Dolph Ziggler, who, of course, was fired a couple of weeks ago on SmackDown, is doing a pretty good job of selling his firing on his Twitter page. Apparently, he made a comment on his Twitter this past week that said, and I quote, just got my first call for a possible booking since being fired. Very exciting. My agency is William Morris. No televised bookings until after May 12th. Let the countdown begin. 90, 89, 88, 87, 86, dot, dot, dot. Basically, he's counting down his 90-day clause. So he's really going above and beyond here to try to sell this as being legitimate. And if we don't see Ziggler back on TV before Mania, which, by the way, I think we should. The guy deserves to wrestle at WrestleMania. And if they're going to have some sort of Money in the Bank match or Battle Royal or something, he should be in there. But I just wonder if he's not, if perhaps they would wait and then at WrestleMania have Ziggler make an appearance and screw Edge out of the championship. I just wonder if they would go in that direction. But I guess we'll see. Now, got some news here on Tough Enough. For those of you who have not heard, the final Tough Enough trainer has been named. And it is, in fact, not a big star like Steve Austin or Booker T or Trish Stratus even. It is Bill DeMott, the former Hugh Morris of WCW fame. And Bill DeMott was a trainer on the last one or two seasons of Tough Enough in its original run before the show ended. He was known as being a hard ass for being an asshole. You know, there's a difference between tough love and being strict, which is probably necessary. In all honesty, it's probably a necessary quality in being a trainer. A lot of people complain loudly about DeMott. You know, DeMott was known for being a bully, basically. And a lot of people did not like him, including when he was a trainer in WWE's old Deep South developmental territory. And before he got fired. So, they brought him back. I guess they saw something in him. I don't know what the rationale was. You probably could have found a million other people to play the same role. Bring back Hardcore Holly while you're at it, if that's what you're looking for. So DeMott will round out the crew of trainers on the show. And got a couple of other news bits here. This actually comes from this week's edition of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. Mr. Dave Meltzer has some interesting news tidbits on this season of Tough Enough here. Apparently, they have taken everyone's computers and cell phones away, which was to be expected. They are really, really clamping down on potential spoilers and leaks on this season. They don't want it getting out even who is on the show. And, of course, already it's already coming out as far as some of the names on the show. Basically, the impression is that at least some of the men and women come from the Florida Championship Wrestling territory, and not just straight off the independents. Apparently, two of the women on the show have relationships with fairly well-known wrestling personalities, one of whom might actually be Jerry the King Lawler, although I can't confirm that. And the King is known for dating, a few years his junior. Apparently, there's several independent wrestlers who did make the cast, and one of the names being thrown out there is former Ring of Honor wrestler Matt Cross. Apparently, is one of the contestants on the show. What's interesting about this is, and I don't know how I feel about this, apparently what makes this season of Tough Enough different from the previous ones is that this show is going to be more heavily scripted. Apparently, it's going to be closer to Hogan Knows Best than the old version of Tough Enough or even the Ultimate Fighter, the UFC show, which has become a big hit in the last couple of years on Spike TV. Yeah, there'll be some form of some form rather of set up storylines and drama, and you know that's kind of par for the course with a lot of reality TV these days. You know, the thing about Hogan Knows Best, that really is an over-the-top example. I mean, within a couple of episodes, it was obvious to me that Hogan Knows Best was a scripted show. And it got to the point of I couldn't even watch it anymore, because you want to watch a reality show with at least some belief that some of the stuff is real and believable. And I'm sure it will be on Tough Enough, but if it's over-scripted, if it's overly scripted, it could really do more harm than good. And I really... like I said, I don't know how I feel about this. You want to have drama. You know, you don't want to have a boring show. So I understand that to a point. But, you know, it depends on who's scripting it, essentially. From what I understand, WWE's production people do not have any real great involvement in this show. It's all Shed Media and the USA Network. Those are the two companies handling it. But who knows? Maybe it's the WWE creative team that's handling the scripting of the show. I don't think it would be. I hope it would. I pray that it isn't. We're just going to have to wait and see. I have a little bit of an uneasy feeling about that. So, I'll keep an open mind about it. Apparently, the contestants were originally chosen in a tryout by Shed Media and the USA Network, not WWE, based on their personality and their physical appearance. Of course, WWE was not happy with the original casting, because it included some well-known independent wrestlers. Wouldn't you know it? Well, when you put out a casting call for independent wrestlers, and you go to the independent promotions and say, hey, we're looking for the best and brightest that you have to offer, you're going to get big-name independent wrestlers. I'm not so sure why they were so shocked and disappointed by this. And basically, this ties into the whole Austin Aries thing. Now, for those of you who are not aware, I cannot remember if I mentioned this last week. Austin Aries is a big former Ring of Honor star, former ROH champion. He was also Austin Starr, for those of you TNA fans out there. And he's a big name, maybe one of the biggest, on the independent scene. And apparently, Austin Aries auditioned for Tough Enough, and it is believed that he probably did make the final cut before WWE stepped in and expressed their disappointment with the people that Shed and USA chose for the show. And so what ended up happening is the woman who was in charge of casting for the show was essentially removed. She was fired from that particular position and replaced by a guy who works more closely with Kevin Dunn, who was the executive producer in WWE. So Austin Aries, who was most likely going to be on the show and had made the cut, was essentially eliminated from the list. So I don't know who the other independent people were that made it and then got cut before getting on the show, but to me, that sucks. That really does suck, because what this tells me is that it's basically a glorified male and female version now of the old Diva Search. And I got to tell you something, I don't miss the Diva Search at all. I know we got Eve Torres from the Diva Search, and Eve has turned herself into a pretty good worker, but I don't want to see another glorified edition of the Diva Search where they're looking for the people who look the best. You know, if you have some talented indie guys that made the cut for the show, who the producers and the people putting the show together thought were interesting in some way, shape, or form, and then you step in and go, hey, you know what, we don't really want these big-name independent guys on there. You know, we have our own idea of who we want. Well, you know what? I know the kind of people WWE wants. Just take a look at the roster down at Developmental. You know, just take a look at the fact that Johnny Ace has been looking through modeling catalogs for years now, picking out the next diva. That's where they're getting this talent from, by the way. I know what WWE's idea is of what these people should look like, and I'm not a big fan of that. So I was really, really gung-ho about this show, and I'm still excited for Tough Enough, but the more I read about this, the more uneasy I get about the whole thing. So, I don't think this is terribly good news for the show. The other big, huge news of the week in the, the WWE universe is where this took place. The announcement that Mystico, or the former Mystico, has in fact signed a deal with WWE. It was confirmed this week in a press conference in Mexico City. WWE sent good old JR, Jim Ross. I'm not sure why they sent Jim Ross, of all people. But it was good to see JR there representing the company, doing the press conference, which was being translated simultaneously to the media there by Carlos Cabrera, who's been the one of WWE's Spanish language commentators for years and years and years. And they made the announcement that Mystico had signed with the company and that he would be now known as Sin Cara, not Sin Caras, as Jim Ross erroneously said, and I think I myself erroneously said initially on Facebook. There is no S at the end. Essentially, translated, it literally means without a face, and that all but confirms that Mystico will be wearing a mask, and in fact, he actually debuted the new look mask that he's going to be wearing, which is a little bit different from the mask he wore down in Mexico. And he was there, and Mystico spoke to the media. It was a big, 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 big deal down there. Apparently, the day after, it was in all the major newspapers and all the major publications, and I have not seen WWE make this big of a deal out of a talent signing since Taka Michinoku, who many of you, if you were fans of the Attitude Era, you definitely remember Taka. You know, he was a big-time Japanese talent that WWE signed. And it's kind of funny the way that worked out, because what happened was they had a pay-per-view, WWE did, in July 1997 called the Canadian Stampede in Your House, which to this day is one of the greatest top-to-bottom WWE pay-per-views ever. It was a very short show. It was less than 2 hours long. It was, you know, it was a pay-per-view when those In Your House shows were not a full 3 hours. You know, and the full 3 hour pay-per-views never go the full 3 hours. So when they would have a 2 hour pay-per-view, it would actually go like an hour 45 minutes. It was not a long show. And they only had like four matches on the entire show. They had a Triple H Mankind match that was pretty good. And then they had a match between Taka Michinoku in his first WWE appearance against the great Sasuke. And I don't care if I'm pronouncing that wrong, but that's how I pronounce it. I pronounce it better than Todd Grisham, by the way. I don't remember whose DVD it was, but WWE did a DVD, and they actually had a match with the great Sasuke against somebody. Now, he kept calling him the great Sasuke, which I don't think that's the correct way of saying it, and even if it was, that just sounds stupid. I call him the great Sasuke. So anyway, the whole point is, he was the big star, and WWE was bringing him in with the expectation that he would be perceived as a big star and would get over, and perhaps they would use him more often, and maybe he would get signed to a contract. So they brought Taka in as kind of another workhorse to just be there, to work with him. You know, Taka wasn't a terribly big guy, and, you know, it's not like they had really any great interest in him. And what ended up happening was, him and Sasuke had a pretty good match, but Taka looked like a total star in that match. And just all these flashy moves, and the crowd was really into him, more so than Sasuke, even though Sasuke won the match, I believe. But Taka really came out of that match looking like a much bigger star. And I think it was not all that long thereafter when they officially signed Taka to a contract. They had a press conference. Vince McMahon was at the press conference to announce the signing of this guy. And I don't remember there being a similar press conference to announce a new talent signing. I'm not saying there hasn't been. I mean, I tend to forget things here and there, but that was the last time I can remember something like that happening. A big international star, a guy that is perceived to be a small guy, no less, which is something WWE is typically not interested in. And they really, you know, they put all this pomp and circumstance together. And I got to tell you, it was really refreshing to see that instead of just signing him to a contract and sending him to developmental without much fanfare at all, and just converting him to the WWE style and maybe making him take his mask off and just taking away everything about the guy that made him a star in the first place. They took the opposite path. They've changed their minds. They were going to send him to developmental. They were going to make sure he took English lessons because he does not know any English. And promos are a very big thing in WWE. Not just promos, but promotional work outside the ring. You know, you need to learn how to speak English if you're going to work for WWE. And he doesn't. And he doesn't know yet how to work the quote-unquote WWE style. But apparently they made a fairly significant investment in him. I don't know how much money he's making or if it's either a big contract that they signed him to or if it's more of they don't want to waste any time in creating the next big Mexican star. They have a tour of Mexico coming up in May. I'm sure that by May they're going to want him to already be over with the audience. So this is they're going against everything that they're known for doing in the past. Apparently they're going to rush him to the main roster. He's going to spend little, if any, time down in Florida. Perhaps while he's up on the main roster, he'll start learning some English. But even apparently that's not a big priority to them right now. He's keeping the mask, although it's a newer version of the mask. And you know, if they really want him to get over as a big star, he's going to get a big push right out of the gate. I don't think he'll make his television debut before WrestleMania, but if not, maybe the night after. I mean, it depends on what brand he's going to be on. To me, it would make sense to put him on SmackDown. Now, here's where things get a little interesting. I am not I'm hardly an expert on the Mexican wrestling scene. I know some people are. And I do know that the drug wars down there are at a fever pitch, and gangs are actually practically running some of these places. There's never been a more dangerous time to be a wrestling promoter down in Mexico, or at least certain parts of Mexico, than it is today. I mean, they'll shake people down, there's been a rash of drug-related murders down there. There's been one or two Mexican wrestlers themselves that have been murdered in recent months. So, I know that's been going on. And from what I understand, Alberto Del Rio, who of course was Dos Caras Jr., big star down in Mexico, big babyface star. His father was a big star. His uncle is the legendary Mil Máscaras. And Alberto came to WWE. He, unlike Místico, did spend quite a bit of time down in developmental, and they did take the mask off of him, and they were changing him. But in Alberto's case, and it doesn't always work out this way, it was a change for the better, because the guy is so damn good in his current role, and without a mask, with those facial expressions and the winking, his in-ring work is improving. His finishing armbreaker submission is really, is really getting over with the audience. The guy's only been on television for a couple of months, and he's main eventing WrestleMania. He already won the Royal Rumble. I mean, if this doesn't tell you that WWE is finally coming to their senses and they realize, holy shit, we need to get some of these younger guys over. Triple H may be leaving soon. The Undertaker is barely surviving. Shawn Michaels is gone. Jericho is not coming back for a while. Batista's still gone. They finally realize we have to get these younger guys over. They're finally starting to push The Miz like a real champion. You know, Alberto's going to WrestleMania. He's only been in the company on TV a couple of months. Místico getting this big pomp and circumstance the other day. Going to be rushed to the main roster. It's refreshing to see. But anyway, back to Alberto. The fact is, Alberto has gotten over very, very well and has become a bona fide superstar on SmackDown. And from what I understand, he does not like Místico. A lot of people don't like Místico. Do a little bit of research and you will find that this guy apparently has quite a few chips on his shoulder and thinks very highly of himself, to the point that I wonder how well he's going to really adapt to being in WWE. I mean, only time will tell. But apparently Alberto, for whatever reason, has some heat with him and just does not like the guy at all. And all of a sudden, I mean, if Místico is going to be rushed to the main roster and possibly even put on the same brand with Alberto, you would think that they may actually have to work with each other at some point this year. And that could politically be a very, very interesting situation, potentially volatile situation to follow. So just an interesting little thing to keep in mind if, 3 months or 6 months from now we hear about problems behind the scenes with Del Rio and with Sin Cara. By the way, I love that name. I've ragged on WWE mercilessly, and will continue to do so for the shitty goddamn names they give people down in developmental. Now, again, Místico not going to developmental, most likely. But, you know, he can't use the Místico name. Apparently CMLL, which is the promotion he worked for before, I think owns the name. And, they're just going to put somebody new. They've even said, they did their own press conference the same day, and they basically said, we're just going to put somebody new under the mask, and we'll call them Místico, which is kind of like apparently what happened with the old Tiger Mask gimmick. There was, I think, Tiger Mask, Tiger Mask 2. I don't know if there was another Tiger Mask after that. So, in any event, the new name, I'm actually a big fan of it. I think there's something to be said for a name that actually has a meaning behind it. You know, like I said, it means faceless or without a face, which seems like a pretty suitable name for a guy that wears a mask that envelops his entire head, including his eye sockets. I mean, if you saw a picture of this mask, I don't think you can see any flesh. you know, behind the mask. Unlike Rey Mysterio, where you can kind of see what he looks like. You know, even CM Punk, when he got shaved bald and put a mask on, you know, you could still see some flesh there. But I dig the name. This is one instance. I don't know whose idea it was. Apparently it was Mystico's, but who knows? Maybe it was somebody in WWE. But whoever came up with that name, thumbs up, because that's actually a name I think that will catch on very easily in WWE. Certainly a lot better than Dolph fucking Ziggler. Actually, now that I say that, I wouldn't mind if Dolph Ziggler came back with his name if he kept the fucking as his middle name. See, when I said Dolph fucking Ziggler, that actually sounds more badass than just Dolph Ziggler. But yeah, something tells me they're not going to do that. All right, I suppose we have to get to TNA now. Oh, TNA. Total nonstop action. Where to start? Well, I suppose we'll start with TNA's big surprise. You see, during the week, TNA was hyping up the shocker of the year. Their exact announcement to the fans on their website and on Dixie's Twitter and everywhere else was, don't miss the final moments of Impact. I don't know if it was final moments or like maybe they said the last 5 minutes or whatever it was. But basically they told all of their fans, don't miss the end of the show because you're going to see the biggest shocker of the year guaranteed. That was how they hyped this thing up. Now, Lance Storm, it might have been in one of his commentaries on his website or in an interview he did, one of his weekly radio appearances, but Lance Storm had a great quote that I absolutely agree with. And he basically said, why would you say, don't miss the final moments of the show? Instead of saying, for example, don't miss Impact this week. I mean, do they not want you to watch the entire show? Are they so self-aware that their shows are horseshit most of the time that they don't even want you watching the whole fucking thing? They just want you to watch the end of the show. Like, is that really what we've come to here? And he makes a very good point. I mean, if I'm promoting the show, I don't go out of my way to tell people, hey, you don't want to miss the very end of the show. That's where the good stuff's going to happen. That was pretty fucking stupid. So anyway, they hyped this thing up, and I know, unlike TNA to hype something beyond belief and not deliver in the end. The big announcement, by the way, and Dixie Carter, and if you've been on FC Scoops, you probably saw the post about this. After Impact aired on Thursday night, Dixie Carter was deluged on Twitter, just absolutely overwhelmed by angry tweets from TNA fans and non-fans alike. And for good reason, because what we saw at the end of Impact was quite clearly a ripoff of the 2/21/11 videos that WWE put together and have been airing over the last couple of weeks that built and built and built to this past Monday night show. And like I said earlier, people in their own minds, when they started seeing those videos, just assumed that it was Sting. They said, oh, this must be a video for Sting. He hasn't re-signed with TNA, and TNA took him off their roster page a couple of weeks ago. And these videos kind of look, they resemble these old Starrcade 97 promo videos that they did for Sting and the build-up to his match with Hulk Hogan and all that. And, well, it wasn't Sting, obviously, but Sting did re-sign with TNA. Sting has returned to TNA television. He will have likely another year, I'm guessing, probably another one-year extension with Dixie Carter and TNA. And so what they decided to do was to be a little bit clever about this. They said, you know what, we're going to put our own video together. And I will say this for TNA, and I said this on Facebook, in their defense, I think it is a smart move on their part to do something with Sting, to build him up in some way. Because Sting, aside from The Rock, certainly before The Rock came back on Raw 2 weeks ago, the biggest superstar in wrestling in the month of February and the most talked about wrestler was Sting. At 51, 52 years of age, hasn't been on TV in a couple of months. He's been floundering in TNA for 6 years. Sting was the most talked about wrestler, certainly on the internet, in the month of February, at least before The Rock came back. And so, if I'm TNA, yeah, I want to take advantage of that in some way. So I don't entirely blame them for that. I'm not saying it was a horrible idea to do something. But what they did was so second rate that anybody who wonders why people call TNA WWE Lite, or people mock TNA for trying to be WWE, a poor man's version of WWE, I give to you the end of Impact on Thursday night as Exhibit A. I mean, it was the video they put together was almost a carbon copy of the video that WWE did, right down to the font. The font! The typeface that they used for the 3-3-11 date at the end of the video, which of course is building to a taped version of Impact coming up that will be airing this Thursday night on Spike TV. This is a show that was taped this week. Now, when did they tape this show, you ask? They taped it on Thursday, which meant that in the Fayetteville, North Carolina market, this was the Impact that was on the road, out of the Impact zone. In that particular market, they competed against themselves. Themselves, I should say. Impact, this big Impact that they were telling everybody, you can't miss the end, you can't miss the end. The people, the poor people in Fayetteville, who didn't have DVR, apparently missed it because they were at a TNA taping while it was actually airing on television. So, way to go, TNA. So, at the taping, and by the way, if you don't want to know what I'm about to say, I'm going to give a major spoiler for Impact this week. So, if you don't want to know what happens, you better stop listening right now and don't bitch to me about it. Sting made his grand return at the TNA taping at Fayetteville this past Thursday. Came out with a new look. If you go on SE Scoops or just search around online, you can find pictures of Sting in his new attire, which is not dramatically different from what he was wearing before. The jacket that he was wearing is different. It's like, it looks like a sequined... he looks like something out of a Siegfried and Roy show in Vegas. But in any event, Sting came out with some new gear, got a big pop, and on his first night back at the TNA taping, this will air on Thursday night, he defeated Jeff Hardy to become the TNA World Heavyweight Champion. And apparently, and I read this somewhere, I did not come up with this on my own, so I by no means am taking credit for this, but from what I read, apparently this makes Sting the fifth oldest man to win a world championship, at least in a major wrestling promotion. He is now only behind Nick Bockwinkel, who was 52, Terry Funk, who was 53, Vern Gagne, who was 54, so was Vince McMahon when he won the WWF title. And this makes Sting number 5 on the list. Sting, I believe, is also 52, or 51. And by the way, we're not counting Vince McMahon's ECW title reign, which, if you count that, he was 61 years old when he won the ECW title, but that title don't mean shit, so that doesn't count. So, and you know what? I'll tell you what. I'm just mentioning this as an interesting fact. I'm not even criticizing them for putting the title on Sting at the age of 51 or 52, because you know what? To me, Sting by no means looks physically the way he looked even 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but Sting does not look like an old man. When I look at Sting, I don't say, oh, look at that old guy. There's plenty of guys in wrestling in their 50s and 60s who look fucking old, who have no business being in the ring, let alone competing for a championship. In Sting's defense, he doesn't look that bad. It's not an issue of age with Sting. Although we can sit here and debate the issue of, is it wise to put the title on a guy who still has a bum shoulder, is 50 years old plus, at the expense of all that young talent they have on the roster that they could be pushing. We could debate that until we turn blue in the face. The point is, they bring back Sting thinking this is going to be a really, really, really big deal. And they're going to quickly realize that even if they pop a big rating for the show, and I expect Impact this upcoming week to get a bigger than usual rating, which by TNA standards probably just means a 1.3 instead of a 1.2. But they're going to find out very quickly that Sting being back in TNA does not mean a goddamn thing. Because, as I said earlier, the real appeal of Sting, the reason people got so excited about Sting's big return, was that it was going to be Sting for the first time ever inside of a WWE ring against The Undertaker in a dream match at WrestleMania. Here's a guy that's never, ever been under contract to Vince McMahon in WWE. Here's a guy who's never had a match with The Undertaker, at least with The Undertaker character. Sting actually did have a match with The Undertaker under his Mean Mark character in WCW in the early 90s. I think they had one match that was not particularly good. But nonetheless, that is what got people excited. Because if people wanted to see Sting and Sting alone, he's been on TNA television for the better part of six years. Apparently they didn't really give a shit then, and they're not going to give a shit now, at least not after the first week. So, congratulations to Sting, I suppose, for parlaying this. He could thank the internet, actually. Maybe he should cut that title in half and give half of it to all the people on the internet that built him up over the last 3 weeks as being a big deal. Probably a bigger deal than he really was. But when I saw that video on him, and that's really the only part of Impact I saw. That's not true. I did see the stuff with Bully Ray and D-Von, which was pretty good. But Bully Ray is just really good in that role. It seems to fit him naturally. But when I saw that video, I just knew. I knew what the reaction would be. Because, look, ideas get stolen and recycled in wrestling all the time. By every promotion in the world. And TNA has been known to, quote, copy things from WWE in the past. And you know what? We could probably find examples of WWE copying TNA every now and then. But this was so blatant. I mean, we just got finished. I mean, that whole angle in WWE just wrapped up on Monday. And on Thursday, they're airing the same video on their own show. Do you know how Bush League that makes you look? Does Dixie Carter realize in her little brain how bad that makes her company look? It's just, it's awful. And I feel so bad for the guys like AJ Styles and Samoa Joe and... You know, I mean, I feel sorry for them to a point. They're the people who keep re-signing. I mean, whenever their contracts come up for expiration, nobody forces them to re-sign with TNA. Apparently, they want to be there. And they probably want to make that place better. And it really is, it's not going to happen. I mean, it really is not going to happen. And that's a sobering thought. And I don't really know what else to say. I just thought that it was a really, really second-rate Bush League thing for them to do. And any bit of criticism they get for that video, they deserve every last drop of it. Because you've got a lot of creative people who do work in that company. And the fact that you have to fucking blatantly steal ideas from the other company. And not even have the I mean, to have the audacity to do it the same week that same storyline is wrapping up on the other show. It almost is like an SNL spoof. You would think that TNA is a comedy show that is simply spoofing stuff in WWE. Only, you know, and they're doing the same shit, but they're doing it worse. I mean, that's not the way you want people to perceive your product, is it? I don't think it is. So anyway, that was pretty fucking stupid. And I also thought it was kind of funny. Unintentional comedy, Jeff Jarrett. You know, Jeff Jarrett is very annoying on Twitter. He's always posting these quotes like he's some sort of, you know, intellectual or something. He's probably going to a fucking quote site and cut and pasting them. But of all the quotes for him to choose, as somebody who is part of TNA and once helped run the organization, he put a quote up on his Twitter this past week, which is actually a quote that is credited to Albert Einstein, of all people. And basically the quote he posted was, "The true definition of madness is repeating the same action over and over, hoping for a different result." He really posted that on his Twitter page. Jeff Jarrett of TNA posted that specific quote on his Twitter page. Amazing. All right, before we get to your mailbag questions here, I just want to make a quick note. I want to thank everybody who sent me an email or posted a comment on Facebook or Twitter about my little fuck-up from the show last week. I made a comment when talking about John Morrison maybe being the first person to cash in Money in the Bank. If, in fact, there is a Money in the Bank match at WrestleMania this year, which has not yet been confirmed, there may not be one. But if there is, I was arguing that Morrison should be in it and should win it. And instead of being one of these guys, typically a heel, who will cash in when the champion least expects it, maybe when the champion has been somehow beaten down, that he should be the first person to actually announce in advance to the champion, face-to-face, that he's going to be challenging him for the title and cashing in his briefcase on such and such a date. And everybody reminded me that, in fact, if he did this, Morrison would not be the first person to do this, that Rob Van Dam was, in fact, the first person to do this in 2006 when he challenged John Cena for the WWE Championship at the ECW One Night Stand pay-per-view. And you're absolutely right. I don't know how I forgot that, but I did. I apologize. I got a lot of emails about this. So apparently a lot of people remember those glory days of 2006. Days gone by. So thank you all who helped me correct that little mistake last week. Also, Kevin, one of the big-time Sound Off fans, wrote in and just wanted me to give a quick shout-out to his friend Kara, or Kara. I'm going to assume this is pronounced Kara. I hope I got that right. A shout-out here on the Sound Off. He said that she would be so happy if I did that and would really appreciate it, so hopefully Kara is ecstatic right now that she has gotten a rare shout-out on the world-renowned Solid Monster Sounds Off podcast here on SEScoops.com. So, I'm so full of shit. Anyway, mailbag time. We got a lot of questions this week, so let's get right into that. John in Northern Ireland, one of our longtime listeners, writes in, "Dear Solid Monster, was just wondering what your favorite face and heel turns were." Well, let's see here. A couple that come to mind here, and I'm just spitting these out as they come to me. Actually, one of my all-time favorites was the Macho Man Randy Savage at WrestleMania 7. Of course, that was the big career career-ending match with him and the Ultimate Warrior, and probably one of, if not the best match Ultimate Warrior ever had in his career. Came on that particular night. Warrior won, which meant the end of Savage's career. He was transitioning for a time to the announce table. And I don't know if, looking back on it now, because when Savage lost that match and seemingly turned face, those first few months of him announcing on television after that, he was still behaving like a heel. He was almost like a heel announcer. And then over time, he just kind of became a face. So it may not have even officially have been a babyface turn, but for all intents and purposes, I mean, nobody's going to really remember that he was a heel on commentary those first few months after WrestleMania. He was a heel going into that match. He had been a heel for a couple of years. He lost, and his manager at the time, Sensational Sherry, was just livid. She could not believe that her meal ticket had lost this match and his career was over, which also meant the end of her career, presumably. And she kicked the shit out of the Macho Man after that match. I mean, the fans were just absolutely disgusted by what they were seeing, and Elizabeth, the real-life wife of Macho Man, his former manager, could take no more. She was in the audience on this particular night and ran to the ring, threw Sherry outside, and reunited with the Macho Man in a moment that I am man enough to admit did at the time bring tears to my eyes, and probably still would if I went back and watched it. It's one of the all-time best angles in WWE history. It's one of the all-time best moments in WrestleMania history. I don't care what anybody says. And that one moment turned Savage an instant babyface, and it's one of my just favorite turns of all time. The Bret Hart turn in 1997, which was a little more gradual, was also a great turn. If you think about it, when Bret Hart came back to the company in late 96 as a babyface, just as he had left, you may recall that he beat Steve Austin at the Survivor Series, and the very next month got a title match with Psycho Sid. And there was already bad blood brewing between Michaels and Hart. Michaels was at ringside for the match and inadvertently cost Bret Hart the match and the championship. And that was when Bret Hart really started to kind of take a turn to the dark side. He was just generally very grumpy and grouchy and felt the world was out to get him. And, you know, he was in the Royal Rumble in 97. He basically won the Royal Rumble match, but the referees didn't see Steve Austin get thrown out. And Steve Austin came back into the ring, threw Bret Hart out of the ring, and won the Royal Rumble, and essentially stole a Rumble victory from Bret Hart. This sent him off the deep end. Bret Hart came out on Raw the next night, quit the company, talked about how he was getting screwed, just completely bitching and moaning like a little crybaby, even though he absolutely made very valid points that he really was getting screwed over. But he was just very whiny and very bitchy, and it was all part of the gimmick, the storyline, which after WrestleMania, they did the double turn with him and Steve Austin in Chicago, and then Bret did this big promo on Raw the next night where he basically said that the American wrestling fans from coast to coast could kiss his ass, and they started the U.S. versus Canada storyline. That was a great heel turn that was, like I said, a little more gradual over the course of a couple of months. Obviously, the Hulk Hogan heel turn in WCW with the Bash at the Beach, 1996, which, in my opinion, that heel turn was a good 3 or 4 years overdue. I always wonder what would have happened if Hogan had done that heel turn in WWF in 92. Because even in 92, I mean, he had a lot of fans, but fans were already getting sick and tired of his shtick. And if he had stuck around maybe in 93 longer than he did, if they had done the heel turn in WWF, how would things have turned out differently for him, for the company, for WCW? It's one of those what-if questions we'll never know the answer to. But it's interesting to think back on. But the Hogan heel turn obviously was a pivotal point not only in his career, and probably added a good five or six years onto his career of being in the main event, but it was a pivotal point in the Monday Night Wars and in the fortunes of WCW. I mean, it just changed the entire wrestling world. So you can't do a list like that without including the Hogan heel turn on there. You know, one other one, just to name one more that comes to mind, which I think often gets overlooked, was from WrestleMania 15 in 1999. Not one of my favorite WrestleManias of all time, but it was in the heart of the Attitude Era. And by the way, only recently did I realize that the subtitle for that pay-per-view was kind of a sexual innuendo. It took me how many years to realize that? They called WrestleMania 15 the Raging Climax, and I'll just leave it at that. But in any event, on that card, there was a match between Triple H and Kane. Triple H came in as the babyface, Kane as the heel, and China, who had turned on Triple H a couple of months earlier and joined Vince McMahon's corporation, came down to reunite with Triple H in this match and helped him beat Kane. Triple H and China left arm in arm to a big, 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 big pop from the crowd in Philly that night. Later that night, X-Pac, one of Triple H's buddies from DX, fought Shane McMahon for the European Championship. And in that match, Triple H came out and, much to the crowd's shock and dismay, turned on X-Pac, gave him a pedigree and cost him the European title match. So, in fact, what we had not seen, we had not seen a babyface turn by China earlier in the show. We actually saw a heel turn by Triple H that nobody in the crowd realized until later that night. I thought that was kind of clever, so I'd put that up there as well. Jared writes in, he says, just wondering if you could master the art of accurately firing a lightning bolt, who in WWE would you make it strike? That guy's question about lightning bolts from the mailbag last week truly made me die laughing. Well, it's not a question of who in WWE, it's a question of what. Because I would have that firebolt accurately fired at that stupid WrestleMania sign. Like I said, blow that thing to smithereens. That's what I would do. Dylan Siraki, big fan of the podcast and a Facebook friend and Twitter follower, as all of you should be, writes in with two quick questions. Number one, in the last sound off, you talked about scripts and scripted promos in WWE. I was wondering, is the sound off scripted? There is no scripting here, I can assure you. As you can, anybody who listens to this show can pretty much tell. There is no script for this show. I just go with the flow. In all seriousness, I have an outline of what I want to talk about. All the big stories of the week, I'll take notes when I watch the shows during the week, because otherwise I'd probably forget half the shit that I watch. So I take some notes on what I want to talk about, and that's literally all I have to go on. And then I log into my my email. I go question by question, and that's pretty much how it works. It's very much off the cuff, and I think this show is better off for you. You don't want a scripted sound off. It wouldn't be as fun. Second question, if WWE is still PG by WrestleMania 30, will WWE be able to call it, since they like to use Roman numbers, WrestleMania XXX? I don't know. One doesn't have anything to do with the other. You know, my guess is they're probably going to go with regular numerals. I don't know. I don't have anything to base that on. I just think WrestleMania XXX looks stupid. So I don't think whether it's PG or not is going to matter. It's going to be with whatever they want to go with. That's it. And by the way, I don't think they are going to be anything but PG come WrestleMania 30, which is, what, 2014? Is that when WrestleMania 30 is going to be? I think they'll still be PG, unfortunately. This question comes from Chris Nichols. He writes in. He says, Dear Solomonster, I'm a massive Chris Jericho fan. And one of the reasons is because I feel he does a brilliant job of being able to work at many different levels in WWE. For example, he can feud for the World Heavyweight title and be a realistic contender, and yet 2 months later he can compete for the Intercontinental or Tag Team Championship and will still be a legitimate contender. It seems like no championship is too high or too low for him to grasp. I feel that a lot of superstars in WWE can benefit from a quality like this. There's been a lot of talk of Sheamus and Daniel Bryan feuding for the U.S. title, and people are complaining, as it seems like a step down for Sheamus, as he is a previous WWE champion. If people had their way, they would want to see him in the main event world title picture all the time. I know he can be in bigger feuds, but do you think this is a positive thing, and that people can come away from this for the better. Well, here's the thing about Sheamus. People are complaining, and rightfully so, because it's not that he's taking a step down. It's that he apparently slipped on a banana peel and has fallen about 20 stories from a high-rise building and is about to plummet down to the pavement. Because if they're not careful with this guy, they're going to kill him dead. I mean, he has been completely just treated like shit. I mean, that's putting it lightly. I mean, the guy has basically been castrated in WWE. It's not that he's just a former world champion. Here's a former world champion that's jobbed more than one time now, cleanly, to Mark Henry, who has had so many start and stop pushes over the years, I've lost count. But for the most part, Mark Henry's booked like a jobber. And Sheamus is losing to him. And not that there's any shame in losing to a guy like John Morrison, but Sheamus has done a couple of clean jobs for him. It seems like every match in the last couple of months, and I'm not talking about their pay-per-view feud from last year, but him and Randy Orton have had about two or three matches on Raw in the last few months, and I think Sheamus has lost each one of those matches clean. And it's great to have a clean finish, but Sheamus, of all people, cannot afford. Sheamus is not Chris Jericho. He does not have that sort of tenure in wrestling or in the company where he's almost Teflon, where he can lose matches like a Chris Jericho or a Shawn Michaels or even a Triple H if Triple H didn't mind losing all the time, which, apparently he does. But Sheamus is not there yet. Sheamus needs to win as much as possible, and that's why people are pissed. He's been treated like a joke, having to come up dressed up in that ridiculous robe and that ridiculous crown and it's almost like winning King of the Ring has actually been a poison pill for his career. It's done more harm than good. That's why people are complaining. But as far as your other point goes, I think you make a very valid one. There's nothing wrong with having somebody like a Sheamus take a step down. He'll probably be treated better and get much better matches being in the ring with Daniel Bryan, whether he wins the U.S. title or not. I mean, back in the day, people forget this, but back in the day, and I'm not talking the 70s, even the 80s, the Intercontinental Championship, which is a fucking afterthought these days. Kofi Kingston is the Intercontinental Champion, and these matches he's been having with Alberto Del Rio, he comes down to the ring with the belt, I guess, but they don't even acknowledge the fact that he's the champion. It's almost like they forgot that he won the Intercontinental title. And once upon a time, that title was even more revered than the WWF title. The wrestlers themselves, the fans, they looked at the Intercontinental Championship as being the real championship, because that was the workhorse title. That was the title that was held by the likes of Tito Santana, Randy Savage, Ricky Steamboat, and later on, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, guys that could really work, Kurt Hennig. The real great technical stars of the company and of the industry fought for the Intercontinental Championship and held the Intercontinental Championship. And there was absolutely no shame in having a big star hold what was basically a secondary title. And there was a period in 2002 where Triple H was the Intercontinental Champion. Kane was the Intercontinental Champion. I liked that. I liked having top stars hold on to that title for a certain period of time and give it some rub. And I think we need to see more of that. Because you can have all the mid-card guys in the world hold on to the U.S. title and hold on to the IC title. And ultimately, you want those guys to compete for the belt. But if the belt already means shit, and the only guys that are holding it themselves don't really mean much of anything, then the belt is never going to mean anything at all, unless you build it back up. And one way to do that would be to have a guy like Sheamus, perhaps, who used to be a world champion, Jack Swagger, who used to be a world champion, and even guys like Rey Mysterio and The Big Show, or Randy Orton, hold on to those secondary titles and ultimately, have a lesser person beat them for it, and hopefully that will give them the credibility they need to be perceived as something other than a job guy. In theory, that's the way that would work. If I were a wrestling booker, that would be my philosophy, but I guess their philosophy differs from my philosophy. So, Luis from Illinois writes in, on Big Show's new DVD, both Triple H and John Cena comment about how the Big Show brought legitimacy to the WWECW title. Was this a shot at RVD or a comment on the fluky way that the title was originated at One Night Stand 2006 when Paul Heyman, as a non-referee, made the three count in the main event? I don't think it had anything to do with either of those things. I don't think it was a shot at RVD at all. And I don't think they were alluding to the fluky way the title was introduced. I think it was simply the ECW title was introduced as a third, literally a third-rate championship belt in WWE. It was never going to be viewed in the same light as the World Heavyweight title or the WWE title. It was just kind of, if you think titles now are an afterthought, you know, they knew it was going to take a lot to make people care about who the ECW champion was. And Big Show went out there. And mind you, at that particular time, Big Show physically was a wreck. And, you know, it wasn't long before Big Show left WWE. I mean, when he lost the ECW title, and I think it was at the, what kind of match was that? I don't think it was an Elimination Chamber, was it? Or maybe it was. It was at the December to Dismember pay-per-view. They had that match where Bobby Lashley won the championship. That might have been Big Show's last match. His back was just completely messed up. That's when he left and did that that independent match in Memphis with Hulk Hogan that did, like, no fans. I mean, the ticket sales were so poor. That was when he actually was back to being Paul White, and he said that he was ditching the Big Show name. That was his slave name. Of course, less than a year later, he was back in WWE. But Big Show busted his ass when he went out there and defended that title. He could have gone out there and phoned it, and he didn't. He went out there and had some pretty good matches. There was one match with Ric Flair where Flair took bumps on thumbtacks and was a bloody mess. I mean, he went out there and really busted his ass. And he earned my respect at the time. And I think that's really what they were implying. That when you see two main event guys like Big Show and Ric Flair going out there, putting it all on the line for essentially what is a nothing championship, all of a sudden people take notice of that. And they start to have a little more respect, not just for the wrestler, but for the title. They must think to themselves, oh, this thing means something here. Look at these guys. They're going balls to the wall here. They're doing things that I ordinarily don't see them doing. This title must mean something to them. I think that's really what they were implying. I don't think it had anything to do with the fluky way the belt was introduced or RVD, to be honest with you. You know, if they were going to take pot shots at RVD, they'd probably do it a little more directly than that. Khan from New York writes in. He's been a listener since episode 100, also a follower on Twitter and friend on Facebook. Dear Solemn Monster, your honest opinion of Randy Orton's in-ring skill. I thought he was a great heel. Sometimes I feel like he can be a bit boring as a face. Well, you kind of summed it up right there. Randy Orton is still very much over with the crowd, although not as much as he was 6 months ago. But as a babyface, he's just boring. And I know why Orton is the way he is in the ring. Orton is very protective of his body in that ring. I mean, most guys should be protective of their bodies, but you'll see Orton take a move, and he takes it in such a way that, you know, I don't think he really gives a shit if it looks fake or not. He is going to go out of his way to make sure he does not get hurt. And I know why he does that. You know, he's had two different occasions where he has broken his clavicle, which is probably one of the more painful injuries that you could sustain. But once the clavicle breaks, your collarbone, it's an injury that is very easy. You know, it's a part of the body that is very easy to re-injure. And in some cases, it could be a career-threatening situation. And so he, I think, because of that, in my opinion, that's why he goes in there and is extra, extra careful in that ring these days about the bumps he takes and the way he lands and the things he does. But just his offense and everything as a babyface, you know, people pop big for the RKO. It's a great move. He can hit it out of nowhere, kind of like DDP used to do. But he's just he's methodical, but he's a little too methodical, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You call him boring, I say you're not too far off. I don't know what he can do to change that. It just might be Randy Orton as a babyface. Maybe he just has to go back to being a heel. You know, maybe he just works better as a heel. But I agree, he's not terribly exciting. He's not lighting my world on fire. I mean, all those pay-per-view matches last year with Sheamus, and he had three of them in a row, I think. None of them lit my world on fire, and I'm not exactly ready to lay all the blame at the feet of Sheamus for that. Let's just put it that way. And even his match at the Royal Rumble with The Miz, you know, didn't exactly get me too excited to see any more Miz-Randy Orton matches in the future. Shaber Rahman writes in, a Solo Monster. Just wanted to know why the pile driver is banned in WWE. I've been a fan since episode 120. Keep up the good work. It was a safety measure on their part. And it's been banned, if I remember correctly, since about 2002 or so. I think is officially when the ban went into effect. Now, of course, The Tombstone Piledriver, as performed by Undertaker and Kane, is excluded from that, because Undertaker and Kane, I mean, they're so closely associated with that maneuver, and they're obviously veterans of the ring that they can get away with it. But even Jerry Lawler, for all the matches Jerry Lawler has wrestled on TV, his recent feud with The Miz, he did tease giving Miz a pile driver at the most recent pay-per-view. I talked about that last Monday in my Elimination Chamber wrap-up. But even Lawler is banned from using his infamous pile driver and has resorted to using the fist drop off the second rope as his finishing maneuver. The last time I can remember WWE doing an angle, I believe it was an injury angle, using the pile driver. I know Steve Austin gave Kurt Angle a pile driver on the outside of the ring, on the exposed concrete, in the fall of 01. But I think this would have been in 2002. There was an angle on Raw involving Val Venus, who might have been part of Right to Censor at the time, giving a pile driver to China and injuring her. And that was the last time in WWE I can remember the pile driver being used. Like the traditional, typical wrestling pile driver. One of the reasons, perhaps, but this would go back, this would push the timeline back a little bit. For whatever reason, I seem to remember that when Undertaker made his big comeback in 2000, and by the way, how many fucking returns has The Undertaker had over the years? I thought about that on Monday night when he came back. I couldn't even begin to count on two hands how many comebacks and returns that The Undertaker has had since his debut in 1990. I mean, his first... it goes back to 94. I mean, 94 is the first time I can remember when, you know, he lost the casket match to Yokozuna. And then he was gone most of that year and then came back for SummerSlam. And ever since then, I mean, it seems like every year there's an Undertaker disappearance and an Undertaker return. But anyway, I seem to recall that when Undertaker made his comeback for the first time as the American Badass and interfered in that Iron Man match at the 2000 Judgment Day pay-per-view with Rock and Triple H, that, first of all, it was kind of funny because what Undertaker was supposed to do was come in at the very end of the match before the buzzer ran. Again, it's a 60-minute Iron Man match, so you've got this countdown clock. And Undertaker was supposed to come in, beat up everybody, give Triple H a tombstone, and then time was supposed to expire, and the buzzer would go off. And Shawn Michaels was the guest referee for this match. And Undertaker came in. The crowd in Louisville was just going apeshit for this man. And he beat everybody up in the ring. He actually punched Vince McMahon legit in the face. And Vince was bloodied up a little bit. I don't know if he broke his nose or not. But they were going a little long with the segment. And Undertaker thankfully did get Triple H for a chokeslam before time expired. And they were smart about it, too, because they had the countdown clock on the screen, and somebody in the production truck realized, holy shit, we better take that clock off the screen, because there were about 4 seconds left when he chokeslammed Triple H. And then he gave the throat slit, waited for Triple H to get back to his feet, and picked him up for a tombstone, and already I'm thinking to myself, all right, that's been more than 4 seconds. And I guess finally they couldn't wait any longer, so Undertaker has Triple H hoisted up, and then the buzzer rings. And Shawn Michaels is just frantically calling for the bell after Undertaker tombstones Triple H. So they had to delay things a little bit. It looked very botched. But I think on the tombstone that Undertaker gave Triple H, he might have actually hurt Triple H. And that probably would have been because he was rushing. Because Undertaker's a pro. I have not heard of too many other instances where he's actually hurt people with that move. But I just remember hearing or reading that he did hurt Triple H. He hurt his neck delivering that pile driver. And that it could go as far back as May of 2000. Because, again, when Undertaker came back, he was using the Last Ride Powerbomb as his finishing maneuver for a time. And eventually they started letting him use the tombstone again. But it's possible it goes back to that incident in 2000. I don't know that anybody knows for sure. But I do recall hearing that story, and I did find it a little odd that Undertaker, even though he had a new look and he was trying to freshen his act up a little bit, would all of a sudden not be using the tombstone at all. I just thought that was a little bit odd. Hunter has a question. He's been a while since he sent in a message here. In recent weeks, there's been a lot of talk about The Rock not being on TV since WrestleMania 20, but he was definitely on Raw a couple of times with good old Eugene. I could have swore I remember this happening. Keep up the good work. Well, first of all, I don't know that they've been saying that The Rock has not been on TV since WrestleMania 20. The Rock has not competed in a match since WrestleMania 20. But what they've been saying is that The Rock essentially has not been live in the ring for them in 7 years. And WrestleMania 20 was 2004. And The Rock segment with Eugene was in 2004. So I don't see where they're being incorrect in stating that. Actually, The Rock, there were two appearances that I can recall. Maybe even three. Might have been three that I can remember. Since he wrestled that last match at WrestleMania. The first one actually came before that. That was when The Rock made a surprise appearance on Raw in late 03. Either late 03 or early 04. To come to the aid of Mick Foley against La Resistance. And then, of course, Rock was revealed to be Foley's tag partner. And for WrestleMania, they came in and beat up Evolution. Rock did the thing with Eugene where Eugene was in the ring with the coach. The coach basically berated him and told him to get the hell out of the ring. Eugene had this big, sad puppy dog face, and The Rock came out, and the place went apeshit. Rock came back to the ring with Eugene, and they proceeded to insult the coach. That was the segment where when The Rock asked Eugene who his favorite wrestler is, he said, Triple H! Which was kind of funny. And The Rock might have had one more Raw appearance before he officially disappeared for good. I think it was something with, it might have been some sort of diva pie-eating contest. It was a complete waste of The Rock. But the point is, he did not, I don't believe, appear on television at all in 2005 onward until a couple of weeks ago. Because it would have been the end of 04 when his contract expired, as I talked about last week. The company just let his contract lapse, and he took great offense to this and didn't want to do anything with them at all. He was thinking of ideas for WrestleMania in 2005, and you know when that went down, all those plans, all those thoughts went out the window. So yeah, it would have been 2004. That would be 7 years. I don't see what's so inaccurate about that. Mark writes in, can TNA get into trouble for ripping off WWE with their 3-3-11 bit? Well, I think they're already in trouble. They're in trouble with their own fans. I mean, if you're saying legally, I don't think that they have anything to worry about. It's not like the concept of the video that WWE did was trademarked. They can pretty much do whatever they want. Like I said, if I'm TNA, most people already looked at it as a bit of a ridiculous spoof, and you can spoof things without having any legal repercussions. Maybe that's the best route for them to go down. It's kind of like when in the old ECW, when they had the Blue World Order, the BWO, because it was a parody of something, you know, they couldn't be sued by WCW. That's why they got away with doing the whole BWO thing. So legally, they don't have anything to worry about. But in terms of their own fan base, I think they have a lot of damage control to do because there were a lot of pissed off people after Thursday night. A lot of pissed off TNA fans, too. Not just the TNA bashers. I'm talking real TNA fans who stick with the company through thick and thin, who even they saw that. And they said, come on, are you kidding me? Seth writes in from Citrus Heights, California. He's a big fan of the show, discovered it back in September, can't get enough of it. Uses it as motivation to do more cardio, plugging into episodes of The Sound Off while jogging around the neighborhood in the evenings. That sounds pretty cool. I've done that myself, although usually I listen back to it with a more of a critical ear, but I'm glad you enjoy it. His question is a pretty good one. What good does The Undertaker's undefeated streak serve other than it's never been done before? Is it only to make that announcement upon receiving his Hall of Fame plaque? I've always been a huge Undertaker fan. I still have my old foam urn. But isn't WrestleMania supposed to be filled with surprises? It's gotten to the point that whoever is facing him, we always know Undertaker is going to win. It's kind of like flat soda. You like the flavor, but it doesn't do anything for you anymore. Frankly, I'm turned off by it. If Undertaker is to be a master of the game, doesn't mastering every aspect include learning how to properly sell a good loss at the show of shows? Predictability is not an attractive quality to have at the grandest stage of them all. Thanks for all the dedicated hard work. Well, thank you. Here's the thing with The Undertaker. The fans don't want to see The Undertaker lose. Now, you might want to see The Undertaker lose because it would be an interesting surprise or an interesting swerve. Hope your name is not Vince Russo, by the way. WrestleMania is not about surprises. It's good to have a surprise every now and then. WWE is not in the surprise business. And I talked about last week on the show that predictability sometimes is the best way to go. Now, I agree that there are very, very, very few matches that Undertaker can have at WrestleMania at this point that don't leave it open for the possibility that fans might actually think he's going to lose. I've said for the longest time now, I have advocated that John Cena is the best opponent for him because Cena always wins. Cena always overcomes. He is Super Cena. And especially at WrestleMania, and Cena has lost at WrestleMania before. You know, he was part of a triple threat, for example, off the top of my head, at WrestleMania 24 that Randy Orton won. Now, it wasn't a singles match, and John Cena, that might actually be his only loss at WrestleMania. So he's got his own pretty strong record at the show. Cena is, I think, the only guy you could put The Undertaker in. Even Sting would not have been enough to convince people that Undertaker would actually win the match. People would have assumed Undertaker is winning, but it'll still be cool to see him in the ring with Sting. You put him in the ring with Cena, and I, using myself as an example, there's still no doubt in my mind that Undertaker is going to win. But I'm willing to bet that a good chunk of people watching that match are going to have their doubts. And when the match is happening, I will be one of those people on the edge of my seat when Cena puts The Undertaker, for example, in the STF, or gives him an attitude adjustment, and goes, yeah, sometimes people will do their finishing maneuver, and then they'll sell that they're too tired or they're injured, and there'll be a delay of about 5 seconds before they actually go for the cover. More often than not, that means, okay, this person's kicking out. What they need to do is have a match with Cena and The Undertaker that goes back and forth for a good 15 or 20 minutes. And maybe Cena already gave him an attitude adjustment earlier in the match that Undertaker kicked out from. You know, after one of those long delays, Cena crawls over, hooks the leg, Undertaker kicks out at 2 3/4, the crowd goes nuts. Wait another 5 minutes to have another near fall, where Cena gets him up for another attitude adjustment after a series of reversals, slams him down, and immediately jumps on top of him for the pin. That is the best near fall that you could have in a Cena-Undertaker match, and I guarantee you, that most of the fans in the building at that show are going to think, holy shit, John Cena is beating The Undertaker. Like, there is a certain way, I mean, here I am booking the match now on the air, but there is a certain way to book that match where you could convince people that Cena would beat The Undertaker. So I agree. There are very few people, and Cena may be the only one, who I think could actually make people believe. And a lot of Undertaker matches because of that at WrestleMania are quite predictable. But you know what? I knew going in that Undertaker was not going to lose to Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 2 years ago. Or last year, for that matter. But I didn't give a shit. I didn't care, because I knew those two guys were going to go in there and have the best match on the show. And not only did they go in there and have the best match on the show, they had one of the best matches I've ever seen. So to me, when it comes to the Undertaker streak at WrestleMania, predictability goes out the window. As much as I really would love to see that match with Cena, I'm hoping they do it next year. If they could possibly wait until WrestleMania 30 at the Garden, that would be the best place for it. I don't know if they could wait that long. But, you know, it's one of those things where the fans don't want to see him lose. You know, you might be one of those people that would like to see it. I guarantee you're part of a very, very small minority. People would be very, very upset. Unless he lost to a very popular babyface, and John Cena is not a widely popular enough babyface to where people would... I mean, if Cena actually beat The Undertaker, I really believe there would be riots in the building. But they do it that way because it's about respect for The Undertaker. It's about respect for him as a performer. It is something they could showcase when he goes into the Hall of Fame. It's something that nobody else has ever done before and nobody else will ever do. And he deserves to have that credited to his name. I fully believe that if WWE came to him and wanted him to lose to a young guy, to put somebody else over, he would do it. Even if in his heart he didn't want to, he would do it. He would make them look good. He would have no problem putting them over. It's not an issue of The Undertaker. It's an issue of the company wanting to keep the streak intact. It's a great marketing gimmick for them every year. That's the other aspect of this that you might not be thinking about. You know, every year we talk about how this is going to be The Undertaker's last match. He's, you know, his arms are falling off, his knees are shot, and, you know, and now he's got shoulder problems. And even still, there's still question, what condition is he going to be in come WrestleMania? Apparently, his shoulder rehab is going a lot slower than they had hoped. Now, if he's in the ring with a guy like Triple H, Triple H is a ring general, and Triple H knows what it's like to wrestle hurt, I'm sure he'll protect The Undertaker as much as possible. I seriously doubt we're going to see The Undertaker doing his trademark dive over the top rope. I don't even think he did it last year. I think he learned his lesson after he fell on his head and almost killed himself 2 years ago. With his shoulder the way it is, I don't think there's a chance in hell he tries that move, and if he does, he's fucking crazy. But the point is, it's a great marketing tool. Every year Undertaker wrestles on the card at WrestleMania, they build everything around the streak. And the minute the streak goes down the tubes, all of a sudden The Undertaker at WrestleMania isn't nearly as relevant as he once was. And that, you know, like I said, I see your point, but for all those reasons, I side with WWE. I think in this case, predictability is perfectly acceptable because I don't want to see The Undertaker lose, and neither do a lot of other people. Got a letter here from Dav from New Jersey. He's been listening to the show since around episode 80-ish or so. His question is, whatever happened to TNA's discussions earlier this year to reduce the number of pay-per-views and or do a special show once a month on a Sunday on Spike? It seems that they do a much better job at building to February 3rd, or now March 3rd, than they do at building to any pay-per-view, which is both sad and expected. But the point is, if you're going to continue provoking or infuriating your audience with the biggest surprise of the year once a month or so, and you are planning these major comebacks and shocking title changes, why not do it live on a Sunday? I'm one to avoid spoilers at all costs, but there was no escaping the big surprise of Sting defeating Jeff Hardy this week. And now we have to wait a whole week to see it. I understand that doing live broadcasts is expensive, and I am very happy to see them take Impact on the road. It's a step in the right direction. But filming it a whole week out and having your big payoff leak all over the world cannot be good for ratings, especially after the bullshit surprise we got this week at the end of Impact. The video itself didn't bother me at all. In fact, I found it amusing. I think it might have even made me chuckle and give an eye roll. They seem to put a little more effort into it than WWE. This would have been so much more effective if they had just copied WWE all the way and put in the middle of the broadcast somewhere and never said a word about it in advance instead of Dixie broadcasting another major surprise. It's really tiring trying to support TNA. Really very tiring. So here we have a TNA fan who wants to see them succeed. And I respect the hell out of Dav for it because he has a hell of a lot more patience as a fan than I ever would have if I were a TNA fan. But he raises some interesting points. As far as your question about why do they seem to be promoting these live specials on Spike more than their pay-per-views, you just said it, my friend. Your guess is as good as mine. These pay-per-views don't mean anything because they put all the emphasis on the TV show. I mean, it's not like TNA in the past isn't known for having an angle or even a match on a pay-per-view that essentially is meant to lead to something on their free television show. They'll do something on pay-per-view promoting Impact on Thursday. And it's fine to promote your TV show, but they'll put stuff on pay-per-view and will not resolve it. And they'll just put it there almost like, the way I can describe it is, if you have an ongoing storyline, and each week there's a new hook or a new development in that story as the story evolves, and something happens on Impact this week, and you have to tune in next week on Impact to see what happens next. That's perfectly acceptable. That's episodic television. I have no problem with that. What TNA is known to do is they will have a match on pay-per-view, or even if it's not a match, whatever it is, they will have an attraction of some kind on the pay-per-view show that people paid $30-something dollars or $40 to see. And on the pay-per-view show, they'll either have a fuck finish, no finish, some sort of screw job, or just no resolution whatsoever if they built up something. No resolution, and instead, they'll say, well, if you want to find out what happened, you got to tune into Impact on Thursday. And if that were me as a paying fan of TNA, I too would be in-fucking-furiated with that company. Because to me, that is the biggest slap in the face you could give the consumer. And when people start to feel like they're being screwed over and betrayed, not a good thing. Not a good thing. TNA has this new philosophy, and this is the philosophy for now, moving forward, that once a month. They want to have a big TV show like they had in February, like they have coming up this week. And they want to put all their emphasis on that show because, and this is amazing, okay? But, you know, Meltzer has talked about this. You know, Wade Keller has talked about this, I'm sure, as well. But from what I've read and from what I've heard, the TNA rationale here is they want to have a big TV show so they can pop a big rating on Spike TV. It's all about ratings with TNA. It's not about pay-per-view revenue. It's all about ratings. They want to pop one big rating each month. And they are not going to put as much emphasis on the pay-per-views because they know that the pay-per-views are not drawing anything. Can you imagine that? I mean, talk about a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah, the pay-per-views aren't drawing anything because you don't promote the fucking pay-per-views. If you started promoting the pay-per-views the way you promote this March 3rd show, for example, if Sting was, like you said, coming back live on pay-per-view and beating Jeff Hardy for the championship, then you might actually have people paying money to see the pay-per-view. But their whole attitude is, well, people aren't going to buy the pay-per-view anyway, so let's try to pop a big rating on Spike TV. Well, what's the point of even doing a pay-per-view in the first place? Pay-per-views aren't free. I mean, it's an expense to put a pay-per-view on. And their pay-per-view numbers are completely abominable. But this is TNA for you. And if I were a bigger TNA fan than I am now, like you are, I too would be reaching the end of my rope right about now. I'd be ready to jump ship. Even if there's no ship to jump into, I would just jump into the ocean. And it's a shame because it really doesn't have to be that way. I was just having a discussion on Friday night with a good buddy of mine, actually, Amish Cousin Simon, who I want to give a shout-out to, made his big in-ring return at the WUW, the World of Unpredictable Wrestling show in Brooklyn at the world-famous Gleason's Gym last night, actually. There was a show. And I was having a discussion with him about TNA on Friday night. And he made the same point to me that I made in this very podcast before. And maybe subconsciously he heard me on the podcast, and so I've rubbed off on him. But the point is, we are standing in the middle of this bar celebrating his birthday. And for whatever reason, our conversation turns to TNA. I cannot think of a bigger buzzkill at a birthday party than talking about TNA. But here we are in a bar, arguing about the fact that TNA has what is probably in totality the most talented roster of young stars in the entire country right now, even more so than WWE, although that is changing rapidly as WWE signs all these newer guys. But they have a lot of talent on that roster, a lot of young, hungry talent, and they don't do anything with it. They don't do anything with any of them. They bring Sting back at 52 years of age, and they put the title on him. They promote TV shows to pop a rating at the expense of their own pay-per-view shows. It just boggles the mind. But I am not the only person who thinks this way. So, I don't really know how you change that. I've said before, the change has to start at the top, and that ain't happening anytime soon. You know, if TNA had promoted the biggest shocker of the year, watch the last 5 minutes of Impact on Thursday, and in those last 5 minutes, Paul Heyman came walking out and said, it's time for a change. You know what? That would have been something worth watching the end of Impact for. But that's the sort of thing where you kind of think about that and then you wake up, you know, and you realize, oh, it was all a dream. Because it's never going to happen. And with the same people in power, like Jeff Jarrett's wonderful quote that he posted on Twitter, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. That is TNA in a nutshell. Emphasis, by the way, on the word nut. And on that note, that seems like a fine end to another fine edition of this podcast. You can email your questions to me. Great mailbag this week. Keep emailing me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solomonster. And, of course, on Facebook, you can friend me there, facebook.com/thesolomonster, as always. You can subscribe on iTunes for free. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off and do leave some feedback for me in the iTunes store, if you will. I really appreciate that. Have episode 149 on tap for next week. I want to just mention a quick thing here. I don't foresee there being any issues, but I may as well just mention it now, just in case. I am I'm going away for a few days. I'm going down to Mets spring training down in Port St. Lucie, Florida. I'm looking forward to that. And I'm flying down there next Sunday. So if there is a sound-off next week, and it would go up no later than Saturday night. But I can't guarantee there will be a sound-off next weekend. Most likely there will be. I'll make every effort to do it the day before, you know, that being Saturday instead of Sunday. I will try my best. There should not be any issues. There should be an episode next week, but I'll keep you guys posted on Twitter and Facebook if that should change. No guarantees, since I am going away, but I just figured let me mention that now, just in case of anything, so... Well, until next time, be well, stay safe. I'm going to go look for my purple pinwheel. I know I left it laying around here somewhere. See you next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.